So take a few minutes to remember your motivation when you started with today, wanting to be of benefit to all beings, wanting to reach enlightenment, to help all beings, and so on, and think that that is your reason for being here, listening to this talk tonight. I thought to start tonight with a couple of questions that came up last week and see if we can answer those questions and then continue with the material on the handout. And I hope to get into the topic of direct perceptions, direct perceivers, and maybe even finish that topic because that's the first of the seven ways of knowing, seven types of awareness. So one of the questions that came up, it was Venerable Pema who asked about bodhicitta and what are the engaged and appearing objects of bodhicitta. So I didn't find that answer, but I thought that we could just discuss it on our own, put our heads together, and see if we can answer that question on our own. I mean, this is a really important mind, bodhicitta. It's what we're trying to develop. We need to develop to progress along the path. We try to do it every day. So it's helpful to try to understand better what is bodhicitta. So does everyone agree that it's a mind as opposed to something material or something permanent like uncompounded space? Yeah, so it's a mind, and being a mind, what does that mean? What kind of qualities does it have? What kind of stuff is it? Clear and knowing. Okay, so it's this non-physical, non-material stuff that knows, that experiences things. And then we started looking at different types of minds. The first division was sense consciousnesses and mental consciousnesses. So every mind, every instance of mind is either one of those. So what do you think bodhicitta is? Yeah. Everyone agree? I think it's pretty easy to see it's not a question of seeing something with our eyes or hearing with our ears and so on. It's a mental consciousness. And then we looked at another division of minds into perception and conception. And with perception, there's actually six types of perceptions. Five sense perceptions, and then also mental perception. And then the other type of mind, conception, is only mental. It's only a mental consciousness. It's never sensory. Okay, so bodhicitta, it could be a mental perception or a conception. So what do you think it is? Conception, why?
Because you're thinking about something. It's an aspiration, it's a wish, so you're conceiving. It's not a direct perception of an object and with the mental consciousness.
Yeah. Any other ideas, assertions, opinions?
If it is ultimate bodhicitta, then wouldn't it be a direct perception of emptiness?
Yes, that's right. There are these two divisions of bodhicitta, conventional and ultimate. And conventional bodhicitta is what we normally understand as bodhicitta, the wish to become enlightened, to help all living beings. Ultimate bodhicitta is said to be the direct realization of emptiness. But is that really bodhicitta? Is that actually bodhicitta? Not really. It's just called bodhicitta, but it's not really bodhicitta. It doesn't fit the definition of bodhicitta. But that you're right. I mean, what you say is right. If you consider those two types of, at least terminological division of bodhicitta, then ultimate bodhicitta would be perception rather than conception. So that's a good point.
I think I also think it's conceptual, but also I'm thinking that the object are sentient beings. So it's how we're...
You what?
In some sense, the object are sentient beings. We're viewing sentient beings and having this aspiration, because it's a primary mind with two aspirations. One is to benefit sentient beings, relieve their suffering, and then the other is to become a Buddha to do that. So the two aspirations have kind of different...
Objects.
It's a hard word to use here because it's so such a technical word, but I don't think we're using that necessarily in a...
Well, every mind has to have an object, right?
Yeah.
You can't have a mind without an object. So this was the question that Pema was asking last week, you know. What, because we had those two types of objects, an appearing object and an engaged object. So what is the, what was your question? Engaged object. What are those two objects?
Yeah, I guess I would say then that it would have to be that the two aspirations have different types of objects, because one is looking at sentient beings, seeing them and having the strong aspiration that they be free of all suffering, the thought.
Yeah, so what I did find in the teachings of the Abhisamayalamkara, the ornament, that's where you find most of the information about bodhicitta. That's the origin. And so that text and its commentaries say that, as you said, yes, it's a primary mind. It's a main mind rather than a mental factor. And it is a mental consciousness. And it has two observed objects. Okay, so this is another term. There's all these different terms for different types of objects. If you've ever tried to look at low rig material, it gets really complicated. Last week we only looked at two types of objects, appearing object and engaged object. But there's all these other kinds of objects. And so there's this one term, it's mikyul in Tibetan, and it's usually translated as observed object or object of observation in Geshe Rabten's book. It's called referent object. So it's said that bodhicitta has two observed objects. Those two are enlightenment and others' welfare. So there are two observed objects of bodhicitta. So then, going back to the original question of engaged object, because it's said that the engaged object is the actual object that the mind is dealing with, that's, you know, engaging with. And I didn't find information about, you know, what's the difference between an observed object and an engaged object, except they do differentiate those two when it comes to a wrong consciousness. So, for example, the conception of an inherently existing I, okay, which we all have in our minds, unfortunately, and we have to get rid of. So it's good to know about that. So this conception of an inherently existing I, the observed object of that is the I that does exist, the conventionally existing I, the merely labeled I. That's the observed object of that mind. And the engaged object of that mind is inherently existing I. So in other words, there is an I, okay? We do have an I, a self, a me that does exist. We do exist. And that's just a merely labeled I. That's its reality. But this conception in our mind looks at that object and doesn't see it as a merely labeled I. Instead sees it as an inherently existing I. So it's like, you know, there's this object that does exist, and then there's this superimposition on top of it, this layer imposed on top of it. And that's what the mind sees. It sees this object that does exist, but sees it in a false way. Does that make sense? So the observed object is the eye, but the engaged object, meaning what the mind is actually engaging with, is inherently existing eye. And if maybe another example, if we take the case of a wrong perception, you've heard about the one about the rabbit horns, right? Rabbit horns, that's what they always use as an example of something that doesn't exist. So I think the story behind that was somebody saw a rabbit with the ears sticking up and thought there were horns. Oh, look at that rabbit has horns. Right? I think that's the origin of that story. So I think in that case, we could say that the observed object is the rabbit with ears sticking up. Okay, the observed object, yeah. The observed object is rabbit with ears sticking up. So that's what's actually there. But what that person saw, the engaged object, was horns, rabbit horns. Okay? So there's an object that exists, that's there, but the person is seeing it wrongly, seeing it incorrectly. Okay? So in those examples, these are wrong consciousnesses. There is a difference between the observed object and the engaged object. And it's useful to know that difference. But I'm thinking, this is my own idea, that in the case of a correct mind, the observed object and the engaged object would be the same. If we see a rabbit with ears sticking up and we see, oh, there's a rabbit with its ears sticking up, then the observed object and the engaged object are the same. The rabbit with the ears sticking up. So then taking that to bodhicitta, this is just my guess, okay? I could be wrong, but I think that the observed object, which is said to be twofold, enlightenment and others' welfare, that these are also the engaged objects of bodhicitta. That's my guess. It makes sense.
So it's kind of confusing for me, since there's two objects. Would it be that a person has to realize one before the other, or do they realize at the same time?
Well, I think in terms of the two aspirations, there is an order. I think the first that comes, if I remember correctly, is the aspiration for others' welfare. That's the one you cultivate first. And then that makes sense. When you're cultivating bodhicitta, you develop strong love and compassion and wanting to help others and so on and so forth. And then the last step of this process is, okay, I have to become enlightened to help all living beings. That's the best way to help all living beings. So I think the first object would be others' welfare. And then to fulfill that, to fulfill others' welfare, you're aiming for enlightenment. That's my guess how they would happen. But I guess by the time you have actual bodhicitta, you can maintain both of those objects. You want to help others. And how do you do it? Enlightenment.
The 7-point cause and effect prove that notion? It seems like it would. For that, first you have the aspiration for others' welfare, and then you develop. I mean, because the way that's laid out is cause and effect.
But it's also what it said in these texts. They don't talk about the sevenfold cause and effect, but they just say that this is the order of these two aspirations. I mean, there might be people who say, I want to become enlightened, but it's not because they want to help all sentient beings, right? But in that case, I don't think that's bodhicitta. That's not bodhicitta. And they probably don't even have a correct understanding of enlightenment. They have their own idea of what enlightenment is, but if it's not because of altruism, wanting to help all sentient beings, it's a mistaken idea of enlightenment. Maybe that's a wrong consciousness rather than coming from the ego. I want to be this great being, better than everybody else. So that's not a correct consciousness. So the actual bodhicitta, correct form of bodhicitta, would be first generating this strong wish to help others, and then wanting to reach enlightenment to carry that out. So, is that okay? Is that okay? Do you feel satisfied? Yeah, actually, last, when was it? I gave those talks about bodhicitta. Was it October, September? Anyway, I have a slideshow and talks about bodhicitta. I could send that to you and you could look at it. There is a lot of information about bodhicitta. Okay, another question that Venerable Pema asked was about this word sem, which that's a Tibetan term, and the Sanskrit is citta. And so I did a little bit of exploration, and it seems sometimes it's translated as mind. For example, in Alex Berzin's that article I mentioned, he translates it as mind. And in Meditation on Emptiness, I forget the page number, but the section about minds and mental factors in the selfless section, he actually has a chart there, and he divides, one way of dividing mind is, or I forget which division he's using, shepa, anyway, is into sem and semjung. Sem meaning primary mind, or main mind, and then semjung is mental factors. So when that division of mind is made into primary minds and mental factors, the term sem is sometimes used. It's also tsosem, primary mind. But it seems that sometimes the word sem is used to refer to primary minds, main minds. If we have time, we can get to that later. That's another division of mind. But each moment of mind, just briefly, each moment of mind, each instance of mind consists of one primary mind, one main mind, and then a number of mental factors. And they all come together in a package. You can't separate them. And the primary mind is said to just be aware of the basic existence of the object. And then the mental factors, each mental factor has its own sort of function or portfolio, you might say, its job. It's like, they say it is a bit like a president and the cabinet or ministers or whatever. The president is the main person, and then there's all these other people who have their own specific jobs that they take care of, and they all work together as a group to deal with issues. So the main mind is like the president, and then the mental factors are like the cabinet ministers and so on. So anyway, that's one way in which sem is used to refer to the main minds. And there are six types of main minds, the five sensory ones and the mental one. But then, as Venerable Lumsel pointed out, in the classes with Jeffrey Hopkins, he pointed out that I think that's more in the context of Kagyu and Nyingma, and it's probably more Tantra, right? He was talking about the Tantra context. So in those contexts, the term sem is used for ordinary mind, like dualistic, mistaken, blah, blah, blah kind of mind. And rigpa, they use the term rigpa for, the more pure kind of mind, non-dualistic mind that we're trying to cultivate. Is that correct? So I think generally notice is that when the Tibetan lamas are teaching, they usually don't mix up sutra and tantra teachings. They keep them separate. Yeah. For example, in the Lowrig books, they don't mention the very subtle mind of clear light. Okay, that's in tantra. It's not that it doesn't exist, but they just don't like to mix things up too much. So, if you're talking about sutra teachings, you talk about those things, and then in tantra you talk about other things, but usually you don't mix them up. So I think since what we're talking about here is more sutra teachings, I think we can just stick with the term sem, meaning mind. It's another term for mind, one of many terms for mind, and maybe more specifically primary minds, main minds. Is that okay? Is that helpful? So where we left off last time, we were in the section on perceptions and conceptions, and just below the chart number 2, which shows engaged objects and appearing objects. So in the case of a perception, like an eye consciousness perceiving a color, the engaged object and the appearing object are the same thing. But in the case of a conception, like a thought, thinking about a color, the engaged object and the appearing object are different because the engaged object is the actual color externally existing. And the appearing object, what's actually appearing to the mind, is this image, mental image, which is called a meaning generality. That's the term. So it's just a likeness of the color, but it's not the actual object. So it's a bit like, I was thinking maybe an analogy is like when we look at something through a window, when you're looking outside, you're looking at things outside the window, you can see what's out there, but not as clearly as if you actually go out there and stand right in front of the object and look at it. So I think in a way that's kind of the way conception works. It looks at an object, but not directly contacting it directly, but instead through this kind of film, you might say, or image of a meaning generality. But conceptions, so in a way, perceptions are considered better because they experience an object much more directly, much more clearly than a conception. But on the other hand, conceptions are very helpful because we can think about anything. Like if we want to look at an object, we have to stand right in front of it, right? But we can think about an object. We can be anywhere in the world and think about an object and deal with it in that way. So it's kind of in a way more flexible, more expansive. So underneath that little chart, it says the engaged object of a conception can be any phenomenon, impermanent and permanent. So we can think about anything, even things that don't exist, like rabbit horns. That would be fun to think about. But for perception, oh, it says, but the appearing object is always a permanent. So appearing objects of conception are always permanent. But when it comes to perceptions, they only know impermanent phenomena, according to this school, not according to Prasangika, but we're looking at Suttrantika now. So according to Suttrantika, perceptions can only perceive things that are impermanent. Impermanent, not permanent. Okay, then the next paragraph is talking about two ways that meaning generalities or mental images can come about. Have you heard this before? One is experiential. So this is when we have a direct cognition of an object. For example, when we see the ocean. Okay, so we've all seen the ocean. So after seeing the ocean, we can think about the ocean. We can have a mental picture of the ocean based on an actual experience after having seen it. The second is called nominal. This arises due to hearing a description of an object that you've never seen. There are people who've never seen the ocean, people who live way inland, people in Tibet, for example, who never went out of Tibet. Okay, they've never seen the ocean. But they've heard about it. So they can generate images in their mind of the ocean based on verbal descriptions or things that you read and so on and so forth. Okay. So in some cases, the mental image that we have may be only based on a direct perception. For example, a little child who sees the ocean. You take a little child, a one-year-old child, to the beach, you know, and they see the ocean. But they don't really know what the ocean is. They're not able to, you know, understand what it is they're seeing. But they still experience it, and they still have mental images of it. Then there are other people who've never seen the ocean, but they can still have a mental image of it based on hearing about it. But then there's a third possibility when those two things are mixed, when you have both a direct perception of an object and you know what it is that you're seeing. Okay, so when you see the ocean and you know that is the ocean, those two things come together. So probably most of us have, most of the mental images that we have are of that nature. But, you know, there are things we've never seen before, but we've heard about them, so we can still have mental images of them. I don't know how important this is, but anyway, explaining these are three ways that we can generate mental images. Yeah.
What category would seeing a drawing of the ocean or a 3D model or a photo?
I know, that's a good question. I think there's a difference, though. I mean, seeing a photo of the ocean and actually being at the ocean is not the same. So I think just seeing a photo of the ocean and then having a mental image of it, that would still be the second type, the nominal one. Yeah, a photo of the ocean is nothing like the real thing, right? So that's my guess. Yeah. But it's better than just hearing words about it. I mean, seeing a photo is much more powerful than. And of course, now we have videos, and even 3D videos. Still not quite the same as the real thing. Yeah, when I was in New Zealand some years ago, there was this young Tibetan guy who went there to translate, to be a translator. And he told me that, you know, he grew up hearing about the ocean, but never saw it, living in Tibet and then in India. And then he went to New Zealand, and the first time somebody took him to a beach, he was so excited. He just ran right into the water with all his clothes on. Just so excited to see the ocean. So he had a real direct perception of probably all five senses, smelling and tasting and feeling and seeing and hearing at the same time. Yeah. Okay, the next bit is about correct or wrong. Okay, so in the case of both perceptions and conceptions, sometimes they can be correct and sometimes they can be wrong. So just some examples. We'll get later, in when we get into the seven types of awareness, wrong consciousness is one of those seven, so we'll get into that more, but just to give you an idea. So some examples of perceptions. A correct perception would be seeing green is green, seeing a tree is a tree. So probably most of our perceptions are correct, but we sometimes have wrong ones. Like, for example, if you see a shape and it's not very bright, you know, the light is kind of dim and you're not quite sure what it is you're seeing, and you can mistake. It might be a tree, but you think it's a person. Or that classic one they always give in the teachings about seeing a coiled rope and thinking it's a snake. I had a friend who had the opposite experience. she was in the garden and the grass was really high, and she saw this thing that she thought was a rope or a hose or something coiled up, and she kind of went close to it, was about to put her hand out and realized it's a snake. So sometimes these things happen. We have misperceptions of things. Yeah, so examples of misperceptions. Seeing green is red. There are people who are colorblind. I had a friend who was colorblind, and he couldn't distinguish red and green. Seeing a reflection in a mirror as a real object. I remember one time walking into I was teaching a seminar in this building, and during a break I went into the restroom. And as soon as I walked in the door, I thought, oh, there's another nun here. How nice. But it was just a full-length mirror on the wall. But my first thought was, it's another nun. Okay. And then with conception, so these can be correct or wrong. So examples of correct would be thinking that the earth is round, thinking that one's body is impermanent, but wrong conceptions, thinking that the earth is flat. Believe it or not, there's still people who think the earth is flat, or thinking that one's body is permanent. So actually, we have a lot of wrong conceptions. All the disturbing emotions, like anger, attachment, jealousy, and so on, those are all wrong conceptions. And then, of course, you know, believing in inherently existing I, and so on. So lots of wrong conceptions we need to clear up. Okay, so the next, any questions so far? Just interrupt me if you have a question, otherwise I'll keep going. Okay, so the next point, letter E, is looking at these two kinds of cognizers. Now, I'm using the term prime cognizer here because that's what Elizabeth uses in her book. I'm just following her. Venable uses reliable, right? Reliable cognizers. Does Jeffrey still use valid? He used to. That's what I grew up on, so I'm kind of partial to that. Valid cognizers. Elizabeth calls them prime cognizers. Venable calls them reliable cognizers. Another term is ideal in Geshe Rabten's book on mind and its functions. The translator uses ideal. So we need to be flexible. It's good to be flexible and not be too attached to one and have aversion for the others. And they're all just different translations. The Sanskrit term is pramana, and the Tibetan is tsema. So it is helpful to know these terms in Sanskrit and Tibetan, just so you know what's being talked about. Okay, so the definition of a prime or reliable or valid cognizer is a knower that is new and incontrovertible. So it has to be a knower, a mind, and then it has to have these two qualities. New means that it's the first moment that we realize the object. Okay. So if we're looking at a flower, for example, so the first moment we see this flower is a prime cognizer. And then if we continue looking at it for several seconds or minutes, the following moments are no longer prime cognizers, according to this school, not according to Prasangika, but according to this school. This is the one we're looking at now. And the reason is they say that the first moment of experiencing an object is kind of powerful. And the following moments just kind of follow along. And a good analogy is a train. In a train, you have the first car. I don't know if you call it car, but the first one is the engine. Okay, and then it's got all these other cars attached to it. So it's the engine that moves by its own power, and the other cars are just pulled along by it. They can't run by themselves. They're pulled along by the engine. So in a similar way, the first moment of realizing an object is like the engine of a train. It realizes it by its own power, and the following moments are pulled along by it, realize it by the power of the first one. So that's why they emphasize the first moment and say that's the one that's really valid or reliable or prime. And then the second term, incontrovertible, complicated word, means that this mind is infallible, meaning it's completely correct. It sees the object correctly, not in a mistaken way, and it's able to induce ascertainment, meaning you're sure that you're sure about what you saw, what you experienced. You know, you see a person, for example, and you know that person was Venerable Children. No, I'm sure it wasn't somebody else. It was definitely her. Okay, you could swear in the Bible it was her. Okay, so that's the meaning of ascertainment. You're sure about what it was you saw. And it's also, it says it eliminates misconceptions about it. Okay, if somebody says, no, no, I don't think it was her. I think it was Venerable Yeshi. And you say, no, 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 it was definitely Venerable Children, I'm sure. Okay, so sometimes we have perceptions of things and, you know, we don't see them very clearly or we're not really sure. And afterwards, you know, we have doubt, you know, was it really her or was it somebody else? Or, right? So meaning of a valid or reliable or prime cognizer is you're sure, you saw the object correctly, you're sure about it, and afterwards you're able to remember it with certainty, with conviction. And it, they also use the word realize, tok in Tibetan. Now, I have another, later we'll get to, there's these different words that they use regarding what the mind does with its objects. Sometimes they say appear, apprehend, realize, ascertain. There's all these different terms, so I found an explanation of them to tell one from the other. But realize means it's very sure. It sees it correctly, perceives it correctly, knows it correctly, and is able to be sure about it afterwards. Okay, next paragraph, it says, an example of a prime cognizer is the first moment of seeing a red rose in which the red rose is seen correctly, and afterwards you are 100% sure that you saw a red rose and not a white one or a pink one or a yellow one. I'm sure it was red. And it was rose and not a daisy or a daffodil or anything else. I'm sure it was a red rose. Okay, so that means you had a valid cognizer. A reliable cognizer. So we have lots of these, okay, in our daily life. So that's an example of a perception. And then with conception, the only valid cognizer that we have, that we can have, of that's a conception is an inferential cognizer. And that's a little more complicated. We'll get to that later. That's number two on the list of the seven types of awareness. But the classic example they always give is realizing sound to be impermanent based on a correct sign. I think the reason they talk about sound is because there was one non-Buddhist system that followed the Vedas. The Vedas were ancient holy scriptures in India. And this, I forget the name of this group, but they believe that the sound of the Vedas was permanent. And so the Buddhists were always trying to convince them, no, sound is always impermanent. It's never permanent. Okay, so there's lots of reasonings to prove that sound is impermanent. But we could use any object, our body, for example, you know. So we have this natural, I think it's probably quite subtle, conception that things are permanent rather than impermanent. Even though intellectually we can say, yeah, yeah, I know my body is changing and it's not going to last forever. But sort of on the gut level, we still feel as if our body is permanent. It's going to last forever. It's not going to get old. It's not going to change. So this conception of things is permanent. So one of the most important things we need to realize on the path is that things that are impermanent and not permanent. And they say that impermanence is a hidden phenomena. Did you learn about that in the three types of phenomena, manifest, hidden, and very hidden? So subtle impermanence is a hidden phenomena. And that means we cannot perceive it. We cannot see it or hear it or smell it with any of our five senses. So the way to realize subtle impermanence, at least the first time, initially, is with an inferential cognizer. And again, we have lots of these inferential cognizers. I was thinking, I don't know if this is a good example, but we've been having a lot of snow recently. Okay, so let's say it snowed during the night and the ground is covered with this layer of fresh snow and you walk out of your house and you see footprints, deer prints or turkey prints or human footprints or something in the snow. So I think you didn't see the person walking there, but you can infer that somebody or some animal walked by there in the last 12 hours, right? So that's an inference. So an inference is something that you use to understand something that's hidden, something you cannot see directly with your senses. But you can infer it by means of signs, by means of like footprints. Okay. Anyway, we'll get to that later. So there's only two kinds of valid minds, direct perceivers and inferential cognizers. So as we progress along the path, these are the two types of minds that we want to cultivate and have more and more of, and gradually get rid of the wrong consciousnesses and the doubts and these less correct states of mind. So that's the real reason, purpose of making this study. So this is just an introduction to these two types of mind, prime or valid cognizers. So those are the ones that are new and incontrovertible. And then any other mind that doesn't have those two qualities is not a prime cognizer, not reliable, not valid. That doesn't mean it's totally wrong, but it just isn't the most correct. Okay, so any mind that doesn't have those two qualities of new and incontrovertible would be a non-prime cognizer. Oh, definitely. That's very wrong. Very non-prime. So just below that, letter F, the seven types of awareness. Okay, so I noticed in the book that you've been going through of Daniel Perdue's, he has a list of seven types of awareness, but it's not exactly the same as this one. You probably talked about that. So this list is the one that's usually found in the Lowrig text. I mean, his is almost the same, but a few differences. And it's also upside down. Sorry. His list starts with wrong consciousnesses. It goes from the worst to the best. So the usual order is it goes from the best to the worst. So these are the seven types of awareness that are normally explained. First is direct perceivers. And then inferential cognizers, subsequent cognizers, correctly assuming consciousnesses, correct assumption, awarenesses to which an object appears that is not ascertained, also called inattentive perception. I think that's one that he left out. And then six is doubting consciousness, and he divided that into three. And then seven is wrong consciousnesses. Okay, so we'll start with the first one, direct perceivers. So, Wunsum in Tibetan. Definition. It's a non-mistaken knower that is free from conceptuality. So I'm taking the definitions from this book, Mind in Tibetan Buddhism. Okay, so there's two qualities here. Non-mistaken. So the meaning of non-mistaken means it's not mistaken with regard to its appearing object. So a direct perceiver must be correct with regard to its appearing object. And the appearing object of a direct perceiver is actually the same as its engaged object. Those two are the same. And so if a perception is mistaken with regard to its appearing object, then it's also mistaken with regards to its engaged object. Can't be mistaken to one and not the other. And therefore, it would be a wrong consciousness. But in the case of conception, that's different, because a conception can be mistaken. It is always mistaken to its appearing object, but still correct with its engaged object. So all direct perceptions are mistaken. Sorry, non-mistaken. And then the second criteria is free from conceptuality. And that simply means that it's not a conception. And there's this other term that they use in the text, determinative knower. And a determinative knower simply means it's a mind that thinks this is this, this is that, this is something else. So it's just, you know, making comments, you might say, labeling, naming, thinking about, making comments about objects. Perceptions just perceive, just experience objects without giving them names or commenting on them and so on and so forth. So it's concepts that do that. And then there's four types of direct perceivers. Sense direct perceivers, mental direct perceivers, self-knowing direct perceivers, and yogic direct perceivers. So the first one is sense direct perceivers. So the definition of this is a non-mistaken, non-conceptual knower that is produced from its own uncommon empowering condition of physical sense power. Okay, so that means the a physical sense power. It could be the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, or the body sense power. That is one of the conditions giving rise to this type of mind. So that means it anything other than a mental consciousness. And this has five divisions. Those that apprehend forms. Form here means physical forms, visual forms like colors, shapes, and so on. Those that apprehend forms, sounds, odors, taste, and tangible objects. So that's not very complicated. Is it? Any questions about that?
Just above that, it says, a knower that apprehends sound in meaning generalities is suitable to be mixed.
Oh, yeah, I kind of skipped that? Over that. Yeah, this is when they give a kind of definition of a conception. This is included in the definition of conception. So in simple terms, before I mention the two ways that meaning generalities can come about, one is by directly perceiving an object, and the other is by hearing about it or reading about it or whatever. So sound, the meaning of a sound generality is a mental image that comes about by hearing a description, hearing about the ocean before you've ever seen it, okay? So then you have a mental image based on sound. And then a meaning generality would, in this case, means the one that you get from actually experiencing it, seeing it, being there, directly perceiving it. So that's simply referring to the sound and meaning generalities are referring to those two types of mental images that we can have. And then saying that they're suitable to be mixed means those two things can become mixed so that we can have a mental image of the ocean based both on seeing it ourselves and hearing about it and learning about it and studying it in university and so on and so forth. I don't know, they have these complicated terms, but in simple terms, that's what it means. And that's just the function of a conception. A conception is that kind of mind that is able to know things in those ways. Okay, next, mental direct perceivers. Okay, so the definition of this is a non-mistaken, non-conceptual knower that arises from its own uncommon empowering condition of mental sense power. So this is a mental consciousness rather than a sense consciousness, but it's a non-conceptual one. Okay, so it knows its object directly rather than through the medium of a mental image. And it's non-mistaken, meaning it experiences its object correctly. And the empowering condition is the mental sense power. And as we saw before, the mental sense power refers to the mind, the consciousness that was there just prior to this one. And it could be any of the six. And so, for example, they say that if we look at an object, like we look at a red rose for several minutes or several seconds, so we have a series of visual, direct perceivers, sense direct perceivers looking at the rose. And then at some point, before we start thinking, before we start having thoughts, conceptions about the rose, there's a very brief moment of a mental direct perceiver. It's so short, so fast that we don't notice it. But it's a mental as opposed to a sense perceiver of the rose. So it's still the mind observing the rose, but, you know, with the mind rather than the eye consciousness. And so the last moment of the eye consciousness, just before it switches to this mental direct perceiver, that last moment of the eye consciousness is the mental sense power for that mental direct perceiver. So that's the kind of mental direct perceivers that ordinary beings like us have, but we're not aware of them because they're too short. And the other example of a mental direct perceiver is clairvoyance, like reading others' minds or remembering past lives and so forth. So probably most of us don't have that kind of experience, but some do. What do you think about dreams? Mental direct perceiver? I mean, they're not sensory, right? They're mental. They're mental consciousnesses because our senses are all out of it. It's mental consciousness. But is it a mental direct perception or is it a conception? What do you think?
I think Jay Rinpoche, Lama Tsongkhapa, says that they're non-conceptual. They could be. So, unless I might have that backwards.
Yeah, I mean, he does have something about that in here. Very, very brief. And he does say that there are different different assertions, different points of view. I forget where it is. But anyway, he says there are some who say they are perception, direct perception. Some say they are conception. There's another text of Lohrig, the one we use in the FPMT basic program, and it's composed by a author named Pubujok. Pubujok was a philosophy teacher of the 13th Dalai Lama. And in his text on Lohrig, he says dreams are perception, wrong perceptions. Well, they could be. He said it depends because if, let's say you dream there's an elephant in your room, okay? That's something they always use. And if you, in your dream, you think there really is an elephant in your room and you get scared and run out, that's a wrong consciousness because there really is no elephant, but you think there is and you're believing in something that's not there. So if you believe in what appears, you believe it to be a real thing, then it's a wrong perception. But there could be cases of correct perception, lucid dreaming. Yeah, I haven't had this experience, but they say people who have lucid dreams are aware, conscious that they are asleep and dreaming, and they don't believe in what they perceive. So they might see an elephant or a tiger, and they know it's not real. So they don't buy into it. They don't believe it. So that would be probably a correct mental perception, according to that author, according to Pubujok. But he also mentioned an example of if in your dream you think that sound is impermanent, that would be a correct if you're a high lama and you've been meditating, studying and meditating all day, you could have dreams in which you think, yes, sound is impermanent.
In transcribing Venerable's teachings that she gave in 2012 on mind, presentation of mind, and awareness. And this one section she says, they say, I don't know who the they is, that dream objects are impermanent, that a dream consciousness is a non-conceptual mind. You are perceiving dream objects, but what doesn't exist is a real dream object, a direct mental perception.
Well, like I say, some, as it says in this book, Latu Rinpoche says, there are some who say they are direct perceptions, but some who say they are conceptions. So there's different points of view, different assertions about it, and it's difficult to know for sure.
There's great teachers who receive teachings from statues and tankas. Is that a mental direct perceiver?
People who receive teachings from statues and tankas.
Yeah. Like Jerry Boucher.
Yeah. I don't know what they say. He would have actual visions of Manjushri and conversations with Manjushri, and I'm not sure. What? Maybe that would be a mental direct perceiver. I'm not sure. That would be quite interesting, wouldn't it? Have the Buddha statue talk to you. Apparently Atisha had a Tara statue that would talk to him. So, yeah, I'm not sure what kind of consciousness that would be.
Another question I had about this that we talked about, but I don't know that we came to a conclusion when it came up in the other class, is in doing the meditation on mindfulness of feeling, trying to understand what's perceiving a painful or a pleasant feeling in the Sutra School.
Yeah, that's not very clear. I wonder about that. I mean, not just feeling, but anything.
Yeah.
There is a mental factor called introspection. Sometimes it's translated as, forget other translations, introspection or... Hmm? Yeah, that's what Alan uses. Clear knowing. Huh? Yeah, that one. They call it sampajana. Yeah, that's in the Pali tradition. I think Alan Wallace uses introspection. Yeah, some use vigilance. Anyway, there's different terms. It's sheshin in Tibetan. And like when we're doing calm abiding meditation, that's a very important factor to observe the mind and know if our mind is on the object or if it's come under the influence of distraction or it's dullness and so on and so forth. So it's kind of the spy, the inner spy that observes the mind and what's actually going on in the mind. And it might be that mental factor that is able to observe the mind itself and what's going on in the mind. I remember having this discussion. I was trying to ask Geshe-ma Kyaltsang Wangmo, and I don't remember very clearly, but yeah, it's not clear. It isn't clear. And it's also not clear if it's simultaneous, like the mind that is able to be aware simultaneously of what's happening in the mind, or if it's the next moment. You know, like, is it a memory consciousness? Oh, the last moment in a moment is so fast. I had that experience. I had anger or I had a bad feeling or whatever. It's just not very clear. I mean, this obviously happens, yeah. Right? We definitely are able to know what's going on inside of our mind, and we need to, and we need to cultivate that. But what's actually going on there is, and it gets a little... Also, this next type of direct perceiver, self-knowing, which we come to, and gets a little unclear about that. So we'll get to that in a moment. Let's finish with mental direct perceiver. So there's two types of mental direct perceivers. The first one is this brief moment following a sense direct perceiver, and the other is the five clairvoyances. There actually are other types of mental direct perceivers number three and number four are on the list are also mental direct perceivers, but they're separated out because they're kind of unique. Okay, so number three, the third type of direct perceiver is called self-knowing direct perceiver. And this is controversial. Some Buddhist schools believe in it and some do not. So the schools that do believe are Sutrantika, Sutra followers, Chittamatra, mind only, and then the one type of Madhyamika, the Yogacara, Svatantrika, Madhyamika. But the Prasangikas, our heroes, do not. Chandrakirti, you know, strongly, you know, refuted the existence of this type of mind. But anyway, within the Sutra school there exists. So this is, I didn't give a definition here because it's better to just try to understand what it's about. So it's a cognition or mind that has as its object another mind, not somebody else's mind, but one's own mind. So for example, if we're looking at a flower, we see the flower. So we have an eye consciousness that's seeing the flower. And simultaneous with that, there's another consciousness that's looking at this eye consciousness. And this is the case with every single consciousness that we have, all our sense consciousnesses, our conceptions, and so on. They all have another consciousness that's aware of them. And the systems that that believe in this, they say this is necessary for memory. If we didn't have another mind observing that perception or conception, we wouldn't be able to remember it afterwards. So it's what accounts for perception. Whereas those schools that say, there's no such thing, they say it's not necessary. Just having an eye consciousness, seeing a flower, is enough to be able to remember it afterwards. You don't need to say there's some other mind that perceives it. I don't think we really need to go into a big discussion about this. But I think in here, I think Elizabeth talks about how we shouldn't confuse self-knowing perceivers with introspection. Some people think it's introspection, but it's not. Because the like Prasangika, for example, can account for awareness of our own mind, what's going on in our own mind, without the need to say that there's this self-knower. Yeah, but then what is this awareness that's aware of awareness? What is it? The function of a self-knower is just to make possible memory of former consciousnesses. It does not have an active role of introspection or self-awareness, as its name might suggest. Such is carried out by a mental factor called introspection. Samprajnana in Sanskrit or Shishin in Tibetan, which can accompany a main consciousness. Okay, so there's this mental factor, which we can call introspection, that you know isn't always there, but it can be there accompanying a main consciousness, and that is able to be aware of what's going on in the mind. So that's what she's saying here, that it's the mental factor introspection that is aware of the mind itself. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is the second moment, remembering the previous moment, but it's so fast like that. Thus, self-knowers are not something which one seeks to develop as part of training the mind. Mm-hmm. Anyway, according to Prasangika, they don't even exist. We can't develop them. Okay, so they just arise kind of naturally and spontaneously, simultaneous with every mind, and they're just looking at the mind itself. So we don't need to spend too much time on that. Let's go to the next one. That's the interesting one. Yogic direct perceivers. And these are also mental direct perceivers, but they're special ones. So the definition is a non-conceptual, non-mistaken, exalted knower in the continuum of a superior, superior meaning an Arya, somebody who's had a direct realization of emptiness, which is produced from a mental stabilization that is a union of calm abiding and special insight, and which has become its own uncommon empowering condition. So this kind of mind only exists in the minds of Aryas. And it's not any kind of object, but it's special objects such as subtle impermanence, selflessness. In this school, they don't really talk about emptiness of all phenomena. So the highest realization would be selflessness of persons, the lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. And first, one cultivates a conceptual realization of these objects via a mental image. And then you continue to meditate. You have to develop calm abiding and special insight. And then combine those two, so you have a union of calm abiding and special insight. And that union of calm abiding and special insight is the empowering condition for a yogic direct perceiver. So this is the type of mind we really need to develop to knock out our delusions and confusion and ignorance and suffering and so on and so forth. This is the thing that will enable one to become free of suffering and progress on the path.
See, is this right then, that a yogic direct perceiver in the mind has to be in the mind of an Arya? So then they might be thinking conceptually or having direct perception of whatever they're attending to. Is that kind of what it's saying? Because they can be conceptual, but you have to be an Arya to have one. So to be an Arya, you have to have a direct realization. That's my one kind of thing that mixes me up. And the other is, okay, it says the object could be subtle impermanence, but you also have to be an Arya. So that's a little confusing too.
Well, what makes you an Arya?
The direct sort of realization of
selflessness. Selflessness in this school, right. So once you have a direct realization of selflessness, you become an Arya.
Right.
And then after you become an Arya, you can have a yogic direct perceiver of subtle impermanence. But before becoming an Arya, you would have a
conceptual
realization, inferential conceptual realization of impermanence. And then once you become an Arya, then you can have the direct perceiver.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. Never asked the question right to get the right answer.
So I'm just wondering if you could have a direct realization of a subtle impermanence before you become an Arya, but it wouldn't be a yogic direct perceiver? I'm wondering. I'm not sure. It seems like you should be able to. No, direct. Direct. You can have a union of calm abiding and special insight regarding impermanence, but it wouldn't be a yogic direct perceiver. That's I'm guessing. I'll try to look that up, but
so if you were to compare the two, you know, this is
question. If you were to compare the two, a union of calm abiding and special insight with a yogic direct perceiver, then there would have to be maybe three or four possibilities. They're definitely not mutually inclusive, because you can have a union of calm abiding and special insight that isn't a direct perceiver. Oh, there's one outlier already. And you can have a union of calm abiding and special insight and not be an Arya. So there's another outlier. from being a yogic direct perceiver. So they're definitely not mutually inclusive.
No, they're not mutually inclusive.
I think I used to think that. Okay.
Yeah, I think it's a progressive thing. So you first develop, let's say, selflessness. So you hear, think, meditate on selflessness, and at some point you'll get an inferential realization, inferential cognition of selflessness. And then you continue meditating on that, deepening your understanding, and at some point you have to develop calm abiding. I don't know if it could be before or after the conceptual realization. And then you bring those two together, your conceptual understanding of selflessness and calm abiding, and eventually you have the union of calm abiding and special insight into selflessness. But you're still not an Arya. So you continue meditating, and at some point it will turn into a direct realization. No more mental image. You see directly. Although in this school, the tricky thing is they say that direct perceivers can only perceive impermanent phenomena, not permanent phenomena, and selflessness is a permanent phenomena. So how does that work? It's explained on page 47 in here. But yeah, what I remember is the direct realization, what it actually perceives are the aggregates, your five aggregates, and they talk about an explicit and an implicit realization. So what is realized explicitly are the five aggregates, in which there's no self, and implicitly, the same mind implicitly realizes selflessness. So the aggregates are impermanent, so the direct perception is realizing those, seeing those, perceiving those, and then kind of by the way, we could say, by the way, you know, on the side, it sees there's no self there. They're empty. Five aggregates are empty of a self. So selflessness is realized by that very mind. It's a direct perception, but, you know, it realizes selflessness. But the Prasangikas have no problem with that because they say a direct perceiver can realize a permanent object, no problem. You don't have to get into such a complicated thing. So it's just the school that makes that distinction. And then in the next paragraph says, both self-knowing and yogic direct perceivers are mental direct perceivers. Okay, so they're not sensory, they're mental. And so that means that, for example, a self-knower that is experiencing an eye consciousness perceiving blue has as its uncommon empowering condition the mental sense power, whereas the uncommon empowering condition of the eye consciousness is the eye sense power. That's important to you or not, I don't know. So let's just look at the next page because there's something that is a little complicated. Because previously we looked at perception, just perceptions themselves, and then, just now we looked at direct perceivers. And then there's also a prime or valid direct perceivers. Not all direct perceivers are prime or valid. Okay? So only some. So the definition of a direct prime cognizer is a new, incontrovertible, non-mistaken knower that is free from conceptuality. So anyway, it has to have all these qualities. It has to be non-conceptual. It has to be non-mistaken. It also has to be new, first moment, and incontrovertible. Like it's completely solid, fallible, you know, certain, and so on. Okay, so an example here. The second moment of an eye consciousness correctly seeing blue is not a prime cognizer because it's no longer new. It's like the second car of a train. Okay, it's not the first one, the engine that has all the power. However, it does still have the quality of being incontrovertible. It's still completely correct, infallible, but just lacks the newness. And so this type of consciousness, the second moment, is called a subsequent cognizer, which is one of the other seven of the seven types of awareness. So I made this little graph here just to show the relationships between these. So the biggest circle are perceptions. Perceptions meaning those minds that directly contact their objects. They could be sensory, they could be mental, they could be correct, they could be wrong. They could be totally wrong. Okay, so that's the biggest circle. And then within that, the smaller circle, number two, would be direct perceivers. So direct perceivers are only perceptions that are correct. They're not wrong. They see their object correctly. But they're not all prime or valid. So that's the smaller circle, number three. So prime direct perceivers that are prime cognizers are those that are correct, those that are new, the first moment. It's a little complicated. But I hope that drawing would make it a little clearer.
This is a little bit of a field, so if it's too far off, that's okay, but I've been puzzling over this for a fair amount of this retreat. Also about the perception of, I mean, understanding a feeling arising, right? And so the substantial cause of that feeling has to be a previous moment of feeling, a previous mind, previous moment, but one of those, right? But then what I'm trying to puzzle over is how in the heck do you posit, and looking at the way the minds are constructed, that a ripening potency makes it a painful or a pleasurable feeling. It seems like that should fall under this mind and awareness topic. I don't know.
Well, feeling is a mental factor. So that's kind of a separate, yeah, when the topic of Lohrig mainly talks about these seven types of awareness. And I think it's a separate text. I mean, in this book, there's only a mention of the list of the mental factors, but not an explanation. But there is, I have another text, which is just about the mental factors, going through all of the mental factors and definitions of each one and so forth and how they work. But still, even, you know, having studied that, it's still a lot of areas that are, yeah, I wonder about that too. I mean, they say feeling is one of the mental factors, and it's ever present. Every single mind that we have has a feeling as part of it. And it's either one of those three, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So it's just like every moment is a feeling. And yeah, they say that that's one of the ways that karma ripens, is the feeling that we have. But how that works? Well, I mean, our mind is just full of imprints from our past actions and so forth. And so, though, I mean, they're probably ripening all the time with all of our experiences. They may also account for why we have wrong perceptions, why we see a rope and think it's a snake, or see a snake and think it's a rope. And the dreams that we have at night and so on. So I think a lot of this stuff, and also like the things that come up in meditation. Yeah, I mean, things from 50 years ago. I was just thinking about that earlier, that one retreat that I was doing, these songs started coming into my mind that I heard when I was a little kid, and I haven't listened to them or sung them or heard them, you know, for 50 years, and there they are in my mind. Where is that coming from, and why? You know, why all of a sudden that song comes up? I don't think anyone can really explain it, but I just think our mind is just full of these imprints. I actually kind of like, I'm sort of attracted to the Chitta Mantra explanation of the mind, Alaya Vijnana, which is sometimes called the storehouse consciousness. It kind of makes sense. It's like this big ocean full of all these fish, all these creatures, you know, and they're just swimming around and poop, 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 popping up here and there. Kind of makes sense in a way. But yeah, I think it's something that we can't really understand logically or whatever. I mean, sometimes you can see, you know, you hear a sound or you smell something and that will trigger off a memory. Grandma's kitchen making cookies or something like that. So that makes sense. But some things, it just doesn't seem to be any trigger for why a particular thought or memory or feeling should pop up. So who knows? Mind is just amazing. Just so complex, so... Yeah. So I don't think we can expect that studying Lohrig, we're going to understand everything. It's going to explain everything about our mind. But it does help. At least it's, you know, give some structure to it all.
Could you say a little bit about how Chanakirti refuted the self-knowing direct perceiver?
I can't remember. I can look it
well,
up.
Well, it's that there, it falls to being inherently existent, but I think, I mean, I guess something.
Yeah, so there's some connection. I found it very difficult. Oh, I found right. that section of the text really hard to understand. Yeah. It went on verse after verse after verse, refuting the Chitta Mantra. So it was just really, really hard. I'll have a look at it again okay. and see if I can make sense of it. But maybe they just say it's totally unnecessary. It's mm-hmm. necessary. You can account for memory simply by knowing an object. That's all it takes to be able to remember it. There's no need to. But yeah, there is also something to do with inherent existence. That, yeah. But that was one of the most difficult parts of the text for me. The Madhyamika Avatara, the supplement to the Middle Way. What? Yeah, it's a long text, so it's going to start from the beginning. Yeah, well, this is chapter 6, so it's way, way in the depths of the text. Yeah, eventually we can get to it. Okay, so next week we'll. I've made a part 2 of the notes. Did you get them? Okay, so there's a few extra topics related to direct perceivers, and then we'll go into inferential cognizers. That's the next of the 7 types of knowing. Okay. Thank you.